Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 65 of Registry Matters. Larry, Saturday night, are you out partying or what?
I'm fixing to be.
You're fixing to? Does that mean you're broken at the moment?
No, for those of you who are not from the South, when you're fixing to do something, that's in the final preparation stages of taking a deliberate act.
On this particular subject, there's a colloquialism in Louisiana and New Orleans that they say they're going to go make groceries. And I still, for the life of me, I have never figured out how that works.
I don't know that one, but I know fixing to do things is like if you were getting ready to go to the store, I'm fixing to go to the store, I'm fixing to go to the mall. It's just as you're getting the final preparation to undertake the action.
And here's another one that bothered me. And then, you know, you look it up in the dictionary and you're like, okay, you're right. But someone would say, yeah, man, I've been down a minute. And I'm like, I a minute? How did you get to that you've been locked up for 10, whatever number of years, and you say, yeah, I've been down a minute? I couldn't figure out how that reference worked. I looked it up in the dictionary, and a minute literally means an unspecified period of time. I was like, okay, I guess that works.
I don't think I've heard that one either.
Yeah, that one bothers me. And then, okay, since we're here, I will give you the final one that drives me absolutely off a cliff. And someone says, hey, man, you know, I was over there with my buddy and we were conversating. I was like, conversating? Really? Not conversing, conversating.
I've heard that one.
That one drives me absolutely off a cliff.
So, yep, I've heard that one.
So what else is up? Any interesting like hotel showerhead stories or anything like that?
No hotel stories. Just one of my, I learned that one of my favorite singers had passed away. And I was listening to the old fashioned radio and they played his best song. And then they said, and he's no longer with us anymore.
Who is this?
Oh, well, that's Freddie Hart.
Who?
Freddie Hart.
I have never heard of such a person. Tell me who, like, I guess, let me Google Freddie Hart and see what I come up with. Tell me about Freddie Hart while I look it up.
He was a country singer, and he performed a lot in the 60s and 70s on TV, and he had a great song called Easy Lovin', and I just thought he was the best singer, one of the best country singers. So,
wait, what was that TV show with the woman that wore the hat that had the little tag hanging off of it? Something Pearl, Mini Pearl. Like,
oh, was that Hee Haw?
Okay, Hee Haw. Did he perform on Hee Haw?
I'm sure he did. I didn't watch all those episodes.
Oh, okay. Hang on. I got a YouTube clip. So let's. God, I can't even imagine what this is going to be like. Are you serious, Larry?
That's Freddie Hart.
Listen to the steel guitars, man. This is terrible. How old was Freddie Hart?
He was only 91.
Only 91. So this guy is like 91. This guy is younger than you are now.
That it comes from not much.
I mean, oh my God, I can't do this kind of music, man. This is terrible. In my opinion, for whatever that's worth. All right, so we don't get a takedown notice.
But I didn't even hear about it. I can't imagine that he could have passed unbeknownst to me, because usually people that have some standing when they leave the world, we get an announcement, and I don't remember hearing this, but it was like in October.
Oh, you mean it like that? You mean like you didn't just hear today like he kicked it? He kicked it four months ago. Well,
yeah, it was like they played the song there. They said, and this is a tribute to the late Freddie Hart. You know, he's no longer with us. And I said, huh?
I didn't even know he was sick.
turned out it was like last fall. And like I say, and he was only 91.
Well, then let's take a moment of silence to remember the late, great Freddie Hart. And that's enough of that.
Maybe we'll start playing records on the Registry Matters podcast each week.
If it's like that, man, I quit. I am totally bailing out of this. I will not do any production work or anything like that if we start playing that old kind of 60s country music. Well, we did get Hank in Nebraska, where like 12 people, it's something like that, how many people live up there. And many, 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 many thanks to Hank. Doubled his Patreonage. And that, you know what? That just gives me a gorbasm, Larry.
What is a Patreonage?
it's me totally messing up the word Patreon and then adding in a to make it like patronage, but so a Patreonage. That's my new word.
Right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Hank. And as I've explained to you before, how is it that there's only 12 people, but they pack 100,000 every home game in Lincoln when they have the Cornhuskers play, and they've done that since 1961?
The answer is a lot of digital work in like during the game, that it's like almost like watching the Matrix, which you've probably never seen. These are not real people. They're just little digital representations of things. It's your imagination.
Yeah, well, tell the people who are stuck in traffic in Lincoln that it's all an imagination, because I've heard that it's really quite congested around that stadium.
And then we did receive an email message. I guess it was a voicemail message, excuse me, from Charles asking is there any update? We're not Narsal, but you should have something to go on from here. Is there any update on Narsal's attempt to get Facebook to allow registrants to be on their platform?
The only thing updating is it's not likely to happen. they took so much heat when they initially took a strong stand that Facebook's open to everyone, but then the news media bashed them, and they took a lot of heat from politicians saying they can't believe that something that's open to minors would be so reckless and disregard the safety of the community. So I don't see them going back on that. I think the only thing that would change that would be a court decision, but I don't see Facebook management. Now, you're welcome to try. I don't want to discourage people from contacting Facebook management, but I just don't see that they would be willing to take the heat.
And unless some sort of entity became, if there were some public private partnership of a social media platform that, you know, it's not censorship because Facebook can do what they want. But if it were a government owned product, that then we would at least have some sort of constitutional claim of a freedom of speech squashing, I think. Right.
Possibly if you were to evolve to the point it was considered like a utility.
Right.
You know, the utility has to serve everyone in their territory, as long as they don't owe them horrendous debts, or if they physically can't serve them, like if they're beyond the reach of their service area. But you know, if you're a mile off the grid and you don't want to pay the fee, but if you want to pay the fee, they'll serve you when you're a mile off the grid from the last customer they have. But
right.
But until we evolve to believing that Facebook is a utility, and that it's compulsory to serve people, I just don't have a lot of optimism that's going to change. Either that or public attitude changing. Do you see public attitude changing?
I hear things from people often, and maybe based on the articles, you know, like the decision out of Alabama, maybe there is some sort of swaying of the opinion, more people being affected by this through family and friends and whatnot, that maybe there's... I don't know. It seems that some people are going to forever say they need to be like, there's no torture bad enough for people convicted of these various crimes. But some people are just like, you know, hey, it wasn't as bad as it sounds. I don't know. It seems like it almost even gets more bifurcated, similar to what our politics has done.
Well, we just did our booth at the Mexico Capitol. And we generally have a pretty good feedback from people who visit. But there were a couple who visited who said basically what you just said, that there was nothing, torture would be bad enough for those kind of people. So we did have some evil people who made evil comments. I won't say they were evil people, but people who made very disparaging comments about our exhibit. And we're going to be back Tuesday exhibiting again. So whoever you are, just be aware, we're going to be back.
You know, this is a halfway decent segue. This isn't on the script, but we talked about it yesterday or today about the a pretty famous R&B singer that has been brought up on charges again of various indiscretions. And I shared with you that I saw a video, and I'm pretty sure it's the same person. And he had someone from the audience come up on stage, and while he was singing a song, he was like practically making out with the girl. Getting all up in her and, you know, dragging fingernails across her neck, just doing all of those things that seem sexy and whatnot. And he does his little song and is kind of dancing around or whatever. And at the end of it, he asks for her name, and she says her name, and he goes, "How old are you?" And she says she's 17. And While I get that there's a certain line where you cross where it's a child versus a, you know, a young adult versus an adult versus age of consent, I get all those lines. But that particular female was up on that stage and was probably ridiculously excited that she was getting the attention of a 40-something-year-old R&B artist who's, you know, he's been around forever. And she was excited, tickled pink that he was showing her attention. But I'm sure her dad would be like, that man is touching my daughter, and that's my daughter, and she's pure, and she's going to be pure until the day she's married. Like, when, I don't know, when do we move to some level of reality that kids have sex?
I don't know. I don't see it coming. I see us headed the other direction. They're perpetually wanting to raise the age of consent, and they want to make sex more taboo. So I don't see us headed in that direction.
It's bizarre, man. God, it's so bizarre. It's so bizarre to me that for whatever reason, girls are hitting mature, like reproductive ages sooner, firing up hormones. Boys are hitting hormone ages at 12 or whatever that number is, you know, it varies, but like the gears are in motion and the desires are there. You can't just say, don't do it. You can't put on chastity belts because things will break through chastity belts.
Oh, they will.
I can almost guarantee, like anything that you put in, you know, I mean, if you say, don't do it, that makes like, don't smoke. Hey, kids are going to go smoke. Don't drink. Kids are going to go drink because you've said, don't. It makes no sense to me.
I'm just playing with you, of course.
I know. All right. Well, James wrote in and James said, I was unsuccessfully trying to sleep tonight because of back pain and itching. So I began thinking about this decision. It came from a federal court, which means that it carries the weight of federal law. The same laws from the government that make your passports. If it is no longer permitted to place the words sex offender on an Alabama driver's license, then the same ruling should apply to passports. I kind of like where he's going there, Larry. They are both forms of identification, one state and the other federal. Of course, Alabama will appeal the decision, but it is hard to deny the judge's reasoning behind his ruling. This is one judge that really knows what's going on and isn't afraid to stick his neck out and try and fix the problem. Too bad there aren't more like him. The federal government has no jurisdiction in any other country. That being the case, the federal government has no business whatsoever informing other countries of a person's status as a sex offender. I have no objections to the monitoring of sex offenders inside of the U.S. as long as it remains in law enforcement's hands, but the government has no jurisdiction in another country and therefore no reason or responsibility to inform other countries about your status. That is, there's a lot there to unpack. And I do see the logic where he's going there between the federal side on the passports in Alabama that, you know, we have the IML stuff with your passport. Tell me what you think.
Right. There's a lot here. And I do agree with where he's trying to go, but he's kind of got a lot of it wrong. The judge didn't say you couldn't mark the driver's licenses. The judge in the Alabama case said you couldn't mark it in that manner.
Yeah, he said there was a lower standard because other states were putting just one little letter or some sort of cryptic code. They could have gone that route. They chose not to shame you.
And a passport. I know this is going to be earth shaking to some of the people who this is a dear issue to. A passport is not a part of your daily life.
Right.
A driver's license pretty much is.
Yes.
Either a driver's license or a governmental issued identification document is pretty much essential for life in these United States.
Yeah.
Try doing your banking, try doing anything without a form of identification. So where international travel is, I know we're going to get heat for this. You have no right to be in a foreign country unless that country wants you there. You have the right to be in the United States buying groceries. You have the right to go to the public library, or you should have that right. You have the right to go to the bank and cash a check. And so the analogy is just not quite there. But I mean, he's in the vicinity of it is a form of compelled speech, which is what the attorney in California argued, that it was compelling the individual to carry the government's message. And so there's a parallel there, but then it begins to fall apart in other ways about the United States having no duty to notify another country. Well, I don't guess we have a duty to, but we certainly have the opportunity to engage in relationships with other countries where we share criminal records and tell the other countries who our criminals are. And I'm just wondering if James would be intellectually honest and say he would be happy to have people come in the United States with no vetting, with countries having information about them that they refuse to turn over to us. And if he would say, Mr. President, we don't need to do any extreme vetting. People that just present themselves to our borders ought to be able to come in. And if he can answer that he's comfortable with that, then we would have an intellectually honest position. But for the United States to say, we would like to have you provide as much information about people who are coming here, and we'll do the same for you, you may not like that, but I can't find anything unconstitutional about sharing information with another country. I mean, I've struggled and struggled and struggled, and no one has been able to convince me that there's something unconstitutional about sharing records. I'm just having trouble finding that.
And it's not an assertion; it's a factual claim. I mean, the person was convicted of a thing.
Yes, and that's going to get to that about the marking on the passport. It doesn't say sexual offender. It says this person has been convicted pursuant to blah, blah, blah section. I forget what it is. I don't have it in front of me, but it's on the endorsements at the back of the passport. It's not the same thing as being on the top line in bold letters. And was it red or orange that they have?
It was bright. Driver's license? Yeah.
Yes. So, like I say, he's heading the right direction, but it breaks down in terms of a country sharing information. I can't find anything wrong with that from a constitutional perspective.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying there. But another thing he says, do you think that it's like a big deal that the judge, quote unquote, stuck at his neck trying to fix the problem?
Well, he certainly stuck his neck out. To my knowledge, this is the first right. ruling of its kind. I generally know, or someone has sure. informed me about these things, that I can't unearth any other incidents. So he's definitely stuck his neck out there. We'll see what the 11th Circuit does with it, because it's almost certain that Alabama would appeal. I mean, they've got to retool all their processes, and they've got to reissue licenses, and they've got to stop doing this. And they're not going to want to stop doing this until they know that they have to. And I would be surprised, even if they lose at the 11th Circuit, they would probably file a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court.
And that, back-to-back weeks, so we had the statement made by the Attorney General in Michigan, and then this decision, completely different states, completely different operations as far as where they fit into the hierarchy of the government. And we were just saying at the top of the program that are the attitudes of the public changing? And here we are with two things that are very similar to each other back-to-back. Maybe?
Well, if it's changing, it's not discernible enough that I can measure it.
Yeah, I
mean, there are people changing. There are people changing. People are recognizing that they're not all from the same cloth. But what the day I dream for is the day when we say that the whole thing is not right. To put someone on a humiliation list after they've paid their debt to society, particularly after they paid the debt. I wouldn't want to do it to anybody, but particularly after they've paid their debt to society. That's just out un-American.
Yeah. Let's move on and listen to a voicemail message from a new listener.
Hello, Registry Matters. The problem stems from how my federal probation is handled. I was charged with possession of child pornography in Iowa, but upon my release, my custody is in Ohio, and this is where I live. I've been on federal probation for a year as of today, and they continue to use my jurisdiction in Iowa. I have no ties in Iowa. So my question is, A, is there a way to refuse to sign these waivers without losing my home? I'd like to be able to challenge them. I'd like to have a hearing. And B, is there still a circuit split regarding access to computers and the internet in simple possession cases? Thank you for your time.
Wow. Even listening to it for the second time, I'm still, and even knowing about it, like talking about it over Discord for a handful of days, it's still a little confusing what's going on. Do you have enough to like start formulating some ideas?
I would feel more comfortable if he clarified when he says waivers. I think I know what he's talking about, but I'm not sure. I suspect they're having him sign agreements to abide by conditions that he was not aware of at the time his sentence was imposed.
I believe so. Yeah,
but. Meaning that he'll waive privacy to his telephone, to his computer, to all this kind of stuff. And if he doesn't, that they'll ship him back to Iowa. That's what it sounds like to me.
And that sounds like that would be torture almost unto itself.
The best thing for him to do would be for, since he's in the federal system, would be for him to contact his local federal defender there where he's living and find out what the lay of the land is in terms of how the federal courts there, because there's an issue of whether the jurisdiction for the case itself has been transferred to the district in Ohio, which, see, the feds can do that. The states can't. If you're serving probation in Georgia, they can transfer the supervision responsibility to Colorado, but they can't transfer the court jurisdiction to Colorado. The court in Colorado never has jurisdiction over you. The court in Georgia does. The court in Colorado can only do what the interstate compact says, which is to hold you without bond if Georgia wants to violate you. And then you go back to Georgia after you've had a probable cause hearing to determine if you're going to be revoked. When the case of the federal, as I understand it, and I'm not an expert in federal practitioner because I've seldom networked with lawyers on federal cases, but my understanding is you can actually transfer the jurisdiction of the case from where the person was sentenced to a federal judge in the jurisdiction where you're living. And if the jurisdiction has been moved, then the federal defender there in Ohio should be able to motion that court there in Ohio to adjust his conditions and supervision, because it would be my lay opinion that if the probation officer gives you conditions, they're valid until they've been removed.
Right.
Because they have broad authority to impose conditions on people that are reasonably related to the underlying offense and don't unduly restrict their liberty and are designed for the safety protection of the community. And they'll assert all of those things. They'll say that they were narrowly tailored. He's got a porn conviction, therefore he was online, so therefore we need to be monitoring his internet. They'll say we're not unduly restricting him. He can have a monitor. We're offering him to have a sign a waiver so that we can carefully monitor him. So we're not going to totally cut him off. We're just going to monitor it very closely. And they're going to say that this is for the protection of the community. That's what they're going to say. That doesn't mean I agree with it, but that's what they're going to say.
I guess we could circle back to this isn't the world that way it should be. This is the way the world is.
That is exactly what I would expect them to do. But I think that he'd be a lot better off talking to a federal defender there in Ohio, wherever he's living, called the Federal Public Defender's Office and explain their situation. And perhaps they will advise him. They're usually a little bit nicer in the federal system because they have greater resources. They don't have 194 cases per lawyer. And they often will let the person talk to an intake attorney, the duty attorney that's on duty for that day. So it's usually a little bit easier to talk to a federal lawyer than it is when you're in the state systems, because the feds have greater resources. They can run $1 trillion budget deficits. Most states are not allowed to do that.
You're not poking fun at anything, are you?
Oh, no, just that the budget deficits doubled in the last 2 years since we've had a new president. Other than that, no, not anything at all. I can't help myself.
A listener on Discord chat said, the judge in my case said I could have a computer before and after prison. The PO threw a bitch fit and then had the judge change it, leaving it up to the treatment provider. Just to go along with what you were just saying about this, the voicemail message.
Yeah, that can happen because the judges tend to be highly deferential to the supervising authorities when they tell them, they're the experts, supposedly. So I'm not surprised that the judge would rein in the condition when the probation people said, well, this is judge, this is how we typically handle this. And this, we prefer that this be carefully monitored at the discretion of the treatment. Oh, okay. I'm not saying it's right, but I'm not surprised.
Right. And you know what else is pretty fun, Larry, is to capture a case that is prescient on our issue in real time.
It is.
So last week we played a clip, and I'm going to play a portion of that clip again about the actor that alleged that he got the crap beat out of him.
Before we play it, let's tell people we didn't have any inside information.
Right. Of course.
We zeroed in on this story because a week ago, when we recorded, it was being alleged by the alleged victim of that assault with the noose and the beating was saying that he found it very offensive that they were questioning him and doubting him. And we opined that that's exactly what they should do. So now we can play the clip to put it in context for anybody who wasn't listening last week of what he was saying when this was from NBC Nightly News.
Tonight, we're hearing from the TV star at the center of a story we've been following, Jussie Smollett, speaking out about the attack he says he suffered last month. Ron Mott has details.
I'm pissed off.
Appearing with Robin Roberts for Thursday's Good Morning America, Empire star Jussie Smollett striking back at those questioning his account of being attacked near his Chicago apartment last month.
Is it the attackers?
It's the attackers, but it's also the attacks. It's like, you know, at first it was a thing of like, listen, if I tell the truth, then that's it, because it's the truth. Mm-hmm. Then it became a thing of like, oh, how can you doubt that? Like, how do you not believe that? It's the truth.
You sent me this clip like maybe last Thursday, so a week and 2 days ago, somewhere in that ballpark, you told me to capture this clip. And at the time, you know, 12 days ago or whatever, about 10 days ago, we didn't know anything. And then sometime midweek, things started to completely unravel that he was supposedly like hanging out with two people that may have been the assailants like a couple hours before. Then I think there may have even been some video of him paying them some money, or at least there was some, credit card or bank transactions that indicated some things going on.
Well, he's been charged by the state authorities and potentially facing federal charges now. But the allegation now is that he arranged the assault and paid $3,500 and wrote out a check for the $3,500. And so as a general rule, I would encourage anybody who's going to do anything to not write a personal check out. That just doesn't seem like the wisest practice. But he paid for that. But what irritates me is that I'm trying to preach about the analogy of just because someone accuses doesn't mean it's true. And just because the police did their job, which I wish they would do in all cases, including sexual offenses, accusations, they told him that we need evidence and your statement isn't checking out. And they expressed doubt, and somehow or another the victim's advocates say that that is re-victimizing someone. No, boys and girls, it is not re-victimizing a person, because the prosecution is attempting to use the analogy I use all the time to put the person in a cage. And cages are not fun to live in for extended periods of time. And we need to have evidence, substantial evidence, before we put a person in a cage. So therefore, yes, we should be sorry for you that you were victimized and you had a noose put around your neck in a case where that really happened. In this case, it didn't really happen. It was made up. But we have to still tell you that we need evidence. We need solid evidence. And that's what the whole point of this, where we put this on last week, is you're not victimizing a person to ask for evidence, to say, I have to hunt for evidence to substantiate what you are alleging. Well, the evidence wasn't there. Well, actually, the evidence was there. In this case, the evidence was unearthed that the man was lying for whatever his motivations were. And they speculate that he didn't think he was earning enough money. $65,000 or an episode was not enough. And then they said it was $130,000 an episode. That's not enough. But whatever his motivations are, he caused a lot of harm. He caused a lot of people to put in laborious amounts of time chasing ghosts and goblins when there are serious crimes happening all over Chicago that weren't investigated because of the distraction. Plus, he caused a national uproar about racism, which is a legitimate thing that happens in this country still today. But this was not it. I mean, this is just so tragic that he would do such a thing. But the lesson to take from it is that people do lie about things that they say that happened to them.
I have a question. Remember, you keep saying a word. It starts with the letter E. The second letter is a V, I think. And this word is completely foreign to me. Evidence? What is this word?
It used to be a part of our criminal justice system. We used to have evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. And now, all of a sudden, in the last 10, 15 years, it's just simply the person saying something.
Right.
A person saying something is evidence. An eyewitness account is a component of evidence. But it's not corroborated if that's all there is. And for putting people in cages, I would like a little bit of corroboration.
Right.
I just, and I know it's not physically possible in some cases. If someone is in certain circumstances, it'll be very difficult to produce evidence. That's how the priests managed to do their things for decades on them without it coming to surface, because all the evidence there existed was the boys, by and large, it was boys, who weren't believed, because how dare you make such an allegation against Father Martin?
Yes, he does so many good things for the community, et cetera, et cetera. That all in that little clip that we played, I mean, he's like really like stepping out there saying like, you guys are a bunch of assholes for thinking that I would lie. Why would I lie?
Well, that's the whole point of it, is that people, there are so many reasons why people tell untrue statements, make untrue allegations and make untrue statements about people. And we couldn't begin to unpack all the reasons why people do it. We will probably never know why he did it. He says, at least the police say he said, the commissioner of police gave like a 17-minute statement Friday, and he's dissatisfied with his earnings. But how can we take him at his word that that's his true motivation? Because he's already proven to be a pathological liar. How can we'll never know what his motivation was.
And describe to me from your point of view, if someone has then been like, they make this allegation, so they have lied once, and now they go and, you know, you find out that they lied about what they were saying. If they then come clean, do you then believe them?
That's my point. I don't think you can believe. I mean, he's apparently given a statement to police, which is not the wisest thing to do, but he's apparently done that, and hopefully it was a counseled decision, not something he did independently, because once he's an accused person, then my job, if people come to me, is to make sure that they don't convict him. It's to make sure that they follow the rules. So we would quickly flip to the other side. But if he made these statements, I don't know how you can take and give any credibility to statements he's made, because he was emphatically, I just told the truth. Well, clearly that was not the truth.
Yeah.
You people don't believe me? Well.
Yeah. Shame on you. Shame on you. You should believe me because I said so.
Hopefully we'll look at this and Duke Lacrosse and the team and the McMartin preschool, and we could go on and on with unsubstantiated allegations that turn out to be crap, and we can start telling the victims' advocates, sorry, there are some things that happen in life that will go unprosecuted. That's just the reality of an imperfect world. We wish it didn't happen, but it's going to happen. Right.
Well, people want the victim, like you would want, if you were the victim of a crime, and you've even described that you were the victim of a crime, you would want the thing to be resolved, and you feel slighted if you're being the victim, you don't get resolution from it in a way that deems you whole, whatever that even means. But sometimes if someone punches you in the face, like if there's no evidence and you just have a bruise on your face and you can't DNA sample, like, you know, find out the exact punch marks and then go get finger knuckle prints to match things up. I mean, there's just no way to prove the case, and you just have to go on and pull your pants back up and figure out how to live on.
And that's not something victims want to hear. Survivors is correct. What they call right. themselves, which I really hate that term. To be a survivor, boy, we're going off on tangents tonight. We'll never get to the articles. But the term for survivor to me would be in a situation where the odds were against you surviving. You have a car crash and the car is mangled and they use the jaws of life to extract you, and you survived that. You're on the Titanic and there's only one lifeboat. And you paddle with the sharks for 3 hours before you're rescued. You survive that. Well, because you're a victim of a crime, only a small number of crimes result in people physically dying. So unless you've been tortured physically and they've been cutting holes in your body and you've been losing blood, I mean, you're a victim of a crime, but you know, I'm a sex assault survivor. Oh, well, what was your sex assault? Well, I was 17 and there was a 24-year-old and he served me alcohol and we had sex. Well, you weren't going to die from having the sex.
Larry, you're so, an I insensitive mean, I, asshole. That's what it comes down to, is you're just an insensitive something.
So I to me, it demeans the, it's anything that, that they do, like, it demeans, it's like calling something rape that isn't rape. Rape would be a horrible thing, to have someone forcibly enter your body. But to say that someone who is having consensual sex in a jailhouse and the two parties are in their 20s or 30s, and to call that rape, that is not rape. It's inappropriate sexual conduct. But to me, it demeans, to call someone a survivor when you were in no danger of being dead, to me, demeans people who survive horrific things. The people, how many years was that girl held in California?
I was totally thinking about the three girls in Chicago or something like that, held by the guy named Castro, that they were like shackled to the floor for 20 years or some ridiculous number. And then there was the girl that was in the tent in the backyard, and probation even came by on a number of occasions.
Yes,
and they're like,
that's the one I was saying.
Those are survivors.
Those are survivors. Yes, yeah. Those are survivors. You know, the person who jumps out of an airplane, the parachute doesn't open, and they manage to walk away with just some scratches. That's a survivor.
They land on a flock of seagulls, and that breaks the fall, and they pick themselves up.
but someone who wakes up, and somebody was in their house in the middle of the night, and they looted them, they didn't survive. Oh, I guess they did survive anything, but they did. But they were in no danger.
Yeah. The threshold doesn't seem to be set very high that that you're a survivor of something. Or the bar is set, whatever. Anyway. All right. Since we have like 45 dozen articles to cover, let's get rolling. Because this first
There's going to go our ratings for sure now.
I know, of course. Well, we keep trying to drive the numbers down, and they keep going up, so maybe we should try harder. This first article comes from the AJC, so the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And I'm going to split the fence on this one. There are really good, like, strategic points, and these are things that you have told me a bazillion times. But this particular politician, if there was ever somebody to give politicians a bad name, this guy is doing it really well. The title of the article, sorry, alleged, I mean, for real, man. So
I don't see a problem with him. Go ahead.
All right. You don't see a problem with the guy. Okay. So alleged victims say powerful Georgia lawmaker repeatedly delays cases. And there's the point that you're going to like. If you are going down the process of some sort of criminal accusation, your best defense is to delay everything as long as possible, because people die, they retire, evidence disappears, stuff happens that helps you. That is the side that you're going to take, which is the best. But this guy is using his political position. He's an attorney, but he's also a state representative, and he's using those, saying, oh, well, hey, I've got to go meet the governor at this time in Savannah for drinks, so I can't be on the court roster. So things get delayed, and you've got people like going into the hospital with broken bones and whatnot, and this guy gets probation for like these anyway. So yeah, this guy, and he's like, you're buying your freedom. So this guy charges whatever they say, $20,000 for him to represent you, and all he does is just put up a wall, and nothing ever then moves forward because he's a state level representative. And something in the Georgia law says that he can delay his attorney duties because he's a lawmaker.
That was the irony. When I found this article, I loved it because it covers so many things. I expect, being that for those who are not in Georgia, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's largest paper, and at least when I was there, WSB TV2 was top of the news rankings, and they may still be. But with those two entities doing a joint investigation, this is not going to end well for Mr. Walston, who's the Speaker of the Georgia House. It's not going to end well for him. They're going to end up having to make changes, in my estimation, to their rules. But they have pretty lax rules about what constitutes legislative business, and being Speaker, the Speaker theoretically would have more responsibilities because they have some administrative duties as well as being a representative. And so he's exploited that by getting continuance after continuance for his clients. And the one that gave the interview that said that he paid it deliberately for the $20,000, to me, that's a goofy. I mean, I don't know why the hell you'd be dumb enough to do something like that, because why would you tell a newspaper reporter that I'm deliberately gaming the system?
Right.
That's going to work out really well for you if you get convicted at some point in the future. That is
going
to be
not
in
like
the pre-sentence report.
We talk about it halfway regularly. Some states, you know, super-duper large population, California's got to be one where it's a year-round legislative process. But Georgia's not one of those. It's just 2 or 3 months out of the year. So, like, you could be an attorney the rest of the time, right?
Well, if Georgia does like I think they do, they probably have interim functions when they're not in general session or special session, and they have committees that are meeting at other points during the year, and then he uses his administrative responsibilities to he's probably in the gray area, but the law is the law. It says since 1905 that a lawmaker has to be excused if they request it, and that's all he's doing is on behalf of his clients. He's requesting. They said one case after 9 years, finally they gave up. Did you see that one?
Yeah, I did. I read the whole article, but that goes to your point of like, if you can delay, do nothing to go for your constitutional right of a speedy trial because shit happens that would go in your favor.
There's very few cases where a speedy trial serves to your benefit. Now, if you're sitting in prison, you're paying the price if you're incarcerated pre-trial, and so the tables were shifted a little bit when you're in custody. But if you're out on bond, there's absolutely no reason that I can think of you'd want your case to be resolved. But people call all the time, "Oh, I can't take this anymore." I said, "Well, you can always plead guilty anytime," but as the case degrades over time. And it's interesting in the article that the prosecution acknowledges that their ability to prosecute is degraded, but they never make the same acknowledgement that the ability to defend in certain circumstances is also degraded. In the cases where no evidence is required, which is sexual allegations, then the ability, it shifts where it doesn't really help the accused because if you're only going to have one witness, and as long as they can get that one witness there, and if that's all that's required, and some statutes say, well, that's all that's required, it's just you can convict only on the accusation alone, that's enough. The people that would help you in your defense, that would vouch for where you might have been, they may be dead or no longer available. So it works both ways. And the prosecution never mentions it can degrade their cases. It can also degrade the defense. And I'd be happy if they'd meet us halfway and say, yes, it degrades both sides' cases if we have delayed justice. Therefore, we should not abolish the statute of limitations because that gives us an unfair advantage on prosecuting something that's decades old.
One final thing before we move on is they listed a whole bunch of people. To me, it seems, you know, they're going down the line of people that would be involved in these kind of cases. And until the last one, the judge in that area says, well, any cases continued for legislative leave on my calendars were continued based on proper requests. It feels like, okay, he is in cahoots with the guy. The Appalachian Circuit District Attorney said that as quickly as these cases can be tried would certainly be ideal, complicit. I believe if there were any concern about a case being unnecessarily delayed, that my office or the judges would address that through the proper legal channels. It's like everyone is just like, yeah, whatever, we're complicit. We don't really care. That to me, that's how it feels that these extra little statements go.
Well, the Speaker of the House is not someone you would really want to speak out against very much if you were smart.
Right. Of course.
Position. And I suspect the Georgia courts are funded by the Georgia General Assembly. And I suspect that you're not going to get people to go crashing against the Speaker. I mean, it's one of those unfortunate things, but I suspect they'll have to modify that and tighten up the amount of leeway they can give them. And they'll probably narrow it down to they're either in session or a special session. And when they're not in session, they probably won't be able to get continuances.
This next article comes from saveservices.org. No idea what this is. The title is States Take the Lead in Making Campus Due Process the Law of the Land. And I guess this comes on the heel of the various different pushback and pullback from the campuses where there's an allegation made and then there's a kangaroo court on the court on the school side versus do you make an actual like let's run it through the full court process, possibly running people, you know, putting them through the ringer of going through the actual court process, alleging things and then putting people on the registry and kicking people out of school. Now you have false allegations, all that to try and standardize something. So there's a bunch of bills going through houses at the state level trying to make this into a more fair process. And the first paragraph, the last little sentence, it says the states are working to establish policies designed to assure due process protections for both complainants of sexual assault and the accused students.
That's amazing that we have to have this conversation. But like I've said on several podcasts, that the rules that were being forced upon the colleges that received federal funding under the previous administration, I thought went too far. And I think that the present administration has tried to restore some semblance of balance to their credit.
Did you just say something good about the current administration?
Yes, I occasionally do.
Hang on, I got to write that down. I'll be right back.
Unlike the people who never could find anything good to say about the previous administration, but I have said multiple times that I think that they've tried to restore some balance in that process. But you don't know how long this administration is going to be in power. We could have a different administration in 2021, which to me it's a good thing that the states are taking the lead, because there should be due process for the students that are accused of this. There should not be a kangaroo court. They should not be shielded from the person who's making the accusation. They don't get to know who it is. They don't get to offer evidence. They don't get to respond. That's not America. And I didn't think we need to spend a whole lot of time on there, but I thought this was good to point out that states are taking the lead.
I do want to share, though, that in the time that I have been talking to you, I think that is probably the most important takeaway of your message is due process, that you have representation, both sides present their evidence, and there's some kind of, like, there's some sort of process. It's not just somebody's opinion. And, like, again, just some kind of due process. That would be the biggest takeaway that I think that you have pushed out to me that I've received.
So, and kudos to the states.
Right. And this is from NWITimes.com, which I have no, I mean, I guess it's Iowa. Or Indiana, excuse me. Northwest Indiana has got to be what this is. Northwestindiana.com. And the title is Felony Registry Would Enhance Public Access. So we have determined that these registries that we have, where you have your picture and your address and your telephone number and all your measurements and what's in your shoe size, we have determined that these things are incredibly effective. And we are going to then make one that if for any felony, you get to have your picture on a public website that people can just search your name and run with it, right?
Don't see a problem with it.
All right, move on. This is garbage. This is garbage because, like, your felony record is already public, so now making it publicer is, like, why? Why do we need to take, if you got convicted of a crime, why do you have to forever, because the internet never forgets, why do you have your stuff listed out there for everyone to find you?
Well, why did the Indiana Senate vote 40-9 to create?
To create the
database. It doesn't seem like public support is waning, does it?
No, certainly not that. No.
So,
all right, we'll move on then.
But that's an overwhelming level of support for a federal policy.
And that's just a couple weeks ago. And 40-9. That's not even. But you know, I don't know what it'll do in the House or anything like that. But yeah, so, you know, we're creating domestic violence registries. We're making pet registries. We're making, you know, we're enhancing all the registries because you got to know who's living next door because you have that right, right?
Well, I don't know. I agree you have any right to know who's next door, but there are those who say that they do.
Yes, of course. And I'm being facetious, so don't take a clip of this and say Andy said he believes in registries. I'm joking. The Wichita Eagle. Go ahead.
That's how we named our network, because of that time when you said, "What am I supposed to tell them when they come to the door?" I said, "Well, if you think you have a right, why don't you start go clipboard, go door to door, and tell people I have a right to know who's in this house and find out what happens."
And the answer is FYP.
That's right. That would be the answer I think most people would give you.
I don't think that that's the answer that most people would give you. I think people would like, "Oh, really? Oh, well, hey, why don't you come on in and take a tour? Would you like some cookies? How about some coffee and tea?"
This article is important to me because of where it's headed, the statute of limitations.
Okay. This is the Wichita Eagle. So Wichita, Kansas, possibly?
No, Montana. Montana.
Well, it says Kansas.com.
Well, the article is talking about the Montana case before the Supreme Court.
It does say the latest on Montana cases before the Supreme Court. So apparently this is Montana.
Yes.
Run it.
So the Attorney General of Montana would like to be able to prosecute old crimes. And unfortunately, he has a statute of limitations. And he sought to charge a guy named Ronald Tipton for a 1987 rape based on new DNA evidence. And the Supreme Court rejected that attempt. So now he's asking the lawmakers to repeal the statute of limitations. Because the you're not required to have a statute of limitations, but if it's on the books and you put your right hand on that Bible, I don't know how you could actually try to charge someone for an old case when the law doesn't allow you to do that. But he did, thanks to you good citizens in Montana that elected him. I'm sure we have at least one listener in Montana. But his beef is that since he can't win in the courts, he wants to have the courts overruled by the legislative process to get rid of statute of limitations. And that's the battles going on all over the country, including in my state.
I still I understand, but why, if we have a new way, like one of the reasons why you would have something like a 7-year statute of limitations or some sort of finite number like that is because what are you going to do? Go find the house, you know, 4 other people have lived there. Everything has been cleaned and all that, but it feels, and I know that DNA is not flawless. It's a statistical analysis, but it gets you pretty freaking close. And we do turn around and we go exonerate somebody with DNA evidence who's been locked up for 30 years and now you're a free man or woman. Why wouldn't we then go both ways? If we'll free somebody based on DNA evidence, then why wouldn't we go back and convict somebody with DNA evidence?
Well, I think you've answered your own question with the way you framed it. If we've taken someone's freedom away incorrectly, and the states do fight those attempts to unravel convictions tooth and nail. It's very rare that they want to let go of a conviction and let someone out of a prison. But your freedom has been deprived. When you flip it over the other way, your freedom is in jeopardy. And yes, the DNA is probably accurate on who it belongs to, but what we don't know is in this 1987 case, we don't know how that DNA got there. We don't know. I could buy into the fact that it's his DNA, but those who would explain how the DNA would be legitimately there, we don't have access necessarily to them after all these decades later. I mean, what would happen if you picked up a hitchhiker across the state of Georgia and they died in the next state over and your DNA was on them and they said, well, how did your DNA get there?
Right. Yeah, you've told me that story. You've used that. I was like, oh, yeah, good point. Yeah, and I remember hearing something, God, in that last handful of years where I want to say it was an Israeli company could fabricate your DNA and plant it somewhere. So now you can't even validate that DNA evidence is anything more than some sort of voodoo magic.
Well, I would be hard pressed to want to put someone in a cage based on DNA alone. But just what the proponents argue, they argue that justice shouldn't have an expiration date, and if we find evidence that wasn't available, we should be able to use that evidence and not be barred by an expiration date. But they forget about the other components of this 1987 case, all the other evidence that's degraded that might be would have been available in a timely fashion. What are we talking about? 87, 97, 07, 17, 32 years ago?
Yeah, a little while. It's been a minute.
So, but I would expect that being that this is the trend of the nation, our Senate, two committees in our Senate have passed a bill to the first effort was to make the statute of limitations go away for crimes that occurred against minors that fell within universal sexual offenses, and then they amended it to be 30 to age 35, and that is on the Senate floor waiting for a vote. It's gotten through the committee process, and I don't see any reason why it won't pass once it gets called up for a vote. So you're talking about someone at 10 years old. They get to their 35, so they've got 25 years to bring forth an accusation, and someone could be put into a cage for that, for what the 10-year-old says 2.5 decades later.
Interesting.
For the recollections of a 10-year-old, but like I say, that was a compromise. They wanted just in most instances, like with in Illinois, they just totally abolished it. after Hastert's, Dennis Hastert, former speaker, after his shenanigans, right. They said, hell, we don't need that at all.
Didn't they do it in Maryland also?
Oh, they did that a long time ago. But with the doctor in Michigan, with the, what is that doctor's name, the gymnastics doctor?
Jesus, you had to say it. Starts with an S, I think. Nasser.
Well, that's the wave of the future. Is that we don't need justice doesn't have an expiration date, and that's their argument.
We have never covered an article from Barron's, and we'll touch on this quickly. But this is an interesting position. I heard an interview with one of the Koch brothers, and that's KOCH. These are oil gazillion bajillionaires. And they are funding massive, massive amounts of money into political campaigns across the country to try and drive the nation in the direction that they want to go. I mean, you know, I guess that's we have the best government money can buy. But specifically to this, I heard an interview on a program called Freakonomics with him, and he is very much, or at least one of the two brothers, I don't know if they're both on board with this, they are very much interested in reintegrating felons, former felons, into society. And here's where he was at a conference and telling his conservative constituents and libertarians, like, when these people get out of jail, they need places to work, and you are the ones that can hire them, and you guys can make a difference in these people's lives. I've heard this from him, like, in my own earballs, and I believe that he is genuine about this idea of reintegrating people back in.
That's why I zeroed in the article. I do think it's the first Barron's article we've ever had, but the Koch political establishment, they've realized that they should be a little bit less partisan. But they've if you read the article carefully, they realize that funding the conservatives have led to the law and order policies now that they think have gone too far, and they're trying to be a little bit more balanced with who their political machinery is funding, and taking a more holistic view, I guess is the way to put it. But them saying hire these ex-convicts, that's a good move. I mean, it's hard to vilify a conservative, like we said before on the previous podcast. Conservatives can get away with doing things that liberals could never think of, and vice versa, depending on the issue. If a Republican president had tried to do the welfare reform in 96, he would have been vilified.
Right. And there's one little segment in there. So some of the people were hardline conservatives, and to hear them say, you know what, I need to rethink this. That was just, it was really giving me goosebumps. Oh, everyone just the group hug. That's what we need to do.
So, but yeah, go Koch. Keep pushing the message out there. That's a good thing.
Absolutely. Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatters at your treatment class, about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. This next article comes from Slate, and the Supreme Court just struck a huge unanimous blow against policing for profit. I ended up hearing about, I can't even remember which podcast it was. I've heard about this. This has been coming down the pike for a while, but a drug dealer, whatever state it was, is driving around in his Range Rover, and it's worth $40,000+, and he gets arrested for something pretty, really small, something that $40,000 Land Rover is 10 times worth what the actual charges are, you know, what fines and fees and so forth. But because of the way things were set up, they can go seize that Land Rover, and that, hey, sorry, dude, you're just screwed because you get to forfeit that as part of your sentence. And the Supreme Court unanimously, which is really interesting, said that the 14th Amendment and that applies now to the states too. So I guess the part of this that still doesn't really quite all the way fit for me is the 8th Amendment is where they can't give you excessive fines and forfeitures and things like that. But that doesn't necessarily apply at the state level. And the 14th Amendment then makes it apply. And then, so here's a case that actually like solidified that condition, I think.
I think so too, but I'm not an expert in this.
But can you imagine getting pulled over for like, you know, a speeding ticket, and some private entity comes in and says, well, sorry, you get to forfeit your car because you ran a red light. The states were allowed to do that by my, I know I'm making an exaggerated extreme case, but that is sort of how this went down, because he used the vehicle to transport heroin. Therefore, the amount of heroin he may have been transporting was like $1,000. But sorry, F you, buddy. You get to forfeit your $40,000 car. So then my question to you, Larry, is that why we see police cars running around? It says this vehicle was donated by whatever, you know, some drug dealer. So now we get to drive around a Corvette.
I think so. And it's something we've been fighting here in my state with the help of both Republican and Democratic lawmakers. It's wrong. But see, it sounded so good at the time when we were in the middle of what we thought was the tidal wave of crime. This was touted as a way to punish the criminal, was to seize the assets, the fruits of the crime. So they got really loosey goosey in terms of what they consider the fruits of which that's this vehicle. They were alleging this was the fruits of the crime. And this all sounds good until you perversely incentivize law enforcement to focus on asset forfeiture and confiscation of people's assets. And then all of a sudden, when you have people who are losing their cars and their property without being convicted, folks across all of the political spectrum started waking up saying, well, that's not what we intended. We wanted the bad guys. We didn't want our constituents that vote for us to be losing their assets. And the DWI is the biggest example where asset forfeiture was going crazy, but these excessive, I mean, that was an excessive fine, $42,000 worth, but you got the Supreme Court united, and even Gorsuch, one of the two appointees of President Trump, he scoffed, apparently, if you read the article, he kind of scoffed at the argument that the state was putting forward. It was from Indiana, and he kind of said, really? Like, spare me from having to listen to your crazy talk.
Right. I don't remember if we covered it, and this is maybe a year, maybe 2 years ago. There was a couple, fairly young couple, as I recall, driving across the United States. They get pulled over for something not, a traffic citation kind of thing. And for whatever reason, they end up doing a search on the car, and they find that they have $50,000 cash. And the police said, there's no legitimate reason that you'd be transporting $50,000 across the state or across the country on your travels. So we're going to seize the money. And they were like, what are you doing? And they seized the money, and it took them an exorbitant amount of time to get that money back.
We're lucky they got it back.
I know, but like, you can't, the home of the free, the land of the brave, blah, 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 do what you want. We're a free nation. Because a cop just says, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, you're transporting $50,000. You must be doing something wrong. Therefore I get to seize it. And I, that seems like a little excessive policing right there to me.
I agree, but thankfully the Supreme Court was unanimous, and maybe that'll send a message to the states.
All right, well, we got to cover the Philly DA Larry Krasner stop seeking bail for low-level crimes. Here's what happened next. Dump, dump, dum. It feels to me like this article is written from a bent saying, this is some garbage, we should not be doing this low bail money thing. It feels like that, but even throughout the whole article, they never, ever say that there have been any negative repercussions of him if it's less than $50,000 for what the bail would normally be set at, just like send him out on your own recognizance bonds.
I thought it said $5,000, but okay. That's what it's showing, that statistically it's not Armageddon, but there was an industry that made their living off of bail bonds. Do you think they're happy that they can't pay their bills now?
Yeah, I gotta think that the bail bonds people, and I don't know how strong a lobby that they would have, they would probably be pretty PO'd.
Absolutely, and then when you destroy people's livelihood, that you're not very popular.
But why then? Okay, so this is not a zero-sum game, because if you, one bondsman supports, I don't know how many criminals, but, or alleged crimes, then you have, is it 100-to-1 ratio? Is it 1,000-to-1? So you put out people that would be working, you've let 1,000 people, whatever this number is, you've let those people go home and continue working, continue family lives. And perhaps these other people have had problems, and it's 100 or 1,000-to-1 ratio.
Well, absolutely. The jail population has been cut, I think they said, almost in half.
Yes.
Dramatically, anyway. And so they're saving gobs of money without any discernible adverse effects so far. But it's when you change the status quo, it's painful for people who don't want to see it changed. We don't like having our cheese moved.
I love that expression. I'm trying to find a place in the article where it says this thing where the only X number of people have spent like one night in jail. I remember reading something along those lines that just said that because of this, people that have been arrested for a thing have only spent one night in jail versus where people would spend days and days and days and days and days in the system. So this is good news. We've covered this, I don't know, what was this, a year ago when he got put into place? And yes. this was the topic that we covered, was that he was going to have telling his DAs, like, hey, you need to cut back on all this stuff. If it's these different kinds of crimes, just send them home, give them their own recognizance bonds, and let that fly. And apparently the people haven't been fleeing, so they've been showing up to court. And the prison population is down, which I think from a conservative point of view, you would be happy, because if you want smaller government, this would make smaller government. You would need less prisons. You would need less prison guards. You would need less food, the whole infrastructure.
You would think so, but sometimes they magically do a flip on that. Small government means small government on things you disagree with.
Absolutely. Are we going to the appeal? Yes, we're going to the appeal article. Why don't we just leave them there? Huh?
These articles are so long that the appeal has, but they're
thorough. I know they are. They are thorough and they're juicy. There's good stuff in them, but we don't have to sit on this for very long, because of course people in prison, why not just cut the power so they don't have running water? You just give them some extra blankets so they don't freeze to death, but they'll be really cold. Don't give them their medical supplies. Again, we can cut down on expenses if we just cut out all their medicine. Then you can't, probably it's really hard to open and close doors because most of that stuff is powered. Again, I don't see a problem.
Well, this article made something abundantly clear that only a very small number of correctional facilities have emergency preparedness plans. And that's kind of tragic, because most of these facilities are built where you can't easily extract yourself in an emergency.
It's kind of the design of it.
Yes. But to think of that, we're going to put people in cages and behind concrete walls and then not prepare for any type of contingency and have emergency preparedness, that's really, really not very nice on our part as a nation.
Definitely not. I really keyed in on the part. I lived in New Orleans for a number of years, and I evacuated from Hurricane Andrew. And then on the heels of that, to see my brother lived in New Orleans when Katrina rolled around, and he actually ended up staying with me for a period of time when Katrina, and his house was under, you know, in like 3 feet of water for a great period of time. But can you imagine if you are then in prison? So, and like, you think, oh my God, we have hardened criminals, so these guys are accused of murder, whatever. But suppose you're down on Bourbon Street and you're having a ruckus time and you get locked up for something, you know, disturbing the public, indecent exposure, just something super duper benign, and they just lock you in overnight. Oh, wait, there's a hurricane coming. And your whole life go like something that would be, you know, you go before the magistrate judge the next day and they go $50 and the gavel falls and you're on your way. But these guys now spend 4 days... 4 days in a two-man cell, just locked, and the water is coming in, and it's like up to their waist, and they're just living in a place that has water to their waist. They're locked in there. The prison guard said, "We're out." And then when they finally get rescued 4 days later, they get taken into a transport vehicle, and they're thrown into a field with 4,000 people, and the corrections officers are then just throwing packouts across the fence at them. And one of these people, his girlfriend, wife, it took her weeks to figure out where he even was, and then 10 days to get him out for something that was just like a massive minor misdemeanor that would have only been just whatever, move on. So there you go. That's how we treat people. And I think we're awesome.
It's really tragic, but like I say, the survey that they tried to do showed that there are very few correctional facilities have planned. They have internal security for riots. They have plans for that, but for natural disasters or power failures, they don't have contingency plans at all. They are prepared to shoot you if you try to break out, though. They have plans for that.
They said that in this whatever this holding place on this field, said that there were rapes. But then the thing that was really the most disturbing, it says that In the wake of Katrina and other of those kind of natural disasters, there are laws in place that require, so here it is. It says the legislation called Post-Katrina Emergency Management Reform Act requires the inclusion of disabled people and even house pets in federal emergency planning, but not prisoners. It feels like we would have already had that in place. We've been locking people up for a really, really, really long time, that there would already be like, hey, there's a hurricane coming. What are they going to do? They're all going home to take care of their families. You're screwed.
Yeah, well, if you don't like this country, I'm sick of hearing you complain about it.
Well, I guess part of that is, can't we fix it?
We could.
Shouldn't we try at least to fix it?
We should.
Don't we have the capacity, even though you may be under supervision, maybe even you live in a state where you can't vote, you either can still talk to your representative, you can talk to your friends and family and try and sway how they vote.
Can.
All right. All right, we're done. Podcast is over. Stop.
So, but prisoners are not a high priority. They don't vote. And they're considered less than human by so many people. And
yeah, they're certainly not worth saving because they're already, God, what do you call it? Do you call them broken people? What do you call it? Damaged goods? There's an expression that you use for people that are in these conditions.
Yeah, and they should have thought, they should have thought about it before they did it.
Ah, yes. That way you get like, I mean, you know, as if execution isn't bad enough, let's lock you in a place where you're just going to drown with three of your closest friends because you did indecent exposure on Bourbon Street and now you're going to drown inside of a cell. That is amazing.
I don't see a problem with it. Let's move on.
All right. From the Miami Herald. This is a pretty stellar human being. Federal prosecutors broke law in Jeffrey Epstein case. Judge rules. I guess this is why you try and hold on to a case and push it down the, you know, delay it as long as possible. This guy, Jeffrey Epstein, allegedly had just scores of underage girls that maybe they were like runaways, drug addicts, whatever. And he would bring them into, he's a multimillionaire, at least if not billionaire, private island, if I'm not mistaken, and having all these, helping out all these girls. And, take us from there. What did the federal prosecutors do wrong?
I'm not really sure because I started reading this and then I ran out of time.
But, okay.
Apparently the judge issued a blistering decision there that's in that story. Of all the wrong stuff. So people who are more interested in what they did wrong, but that isn't that person a part of the cabinet now? That was the prosecutor.
Yes, that is former Miami U.S. Attorney Alex Acosta. And what position is he holding now, Alex?
I thought he serves in the cabinet of the United States president.
Reen Alexander Acosta is an American attorney, academic, and politician who is the 27th and current United States Secretary of Labor. Oh, I saw a clip of him with Trump just earlier. Yep. That's what I saw. I didn't pay attention to that because they were actually playing a clip of something else. But he was like, what about this guy? He's like, I don't know, man. I don't know anything about it. He's doing a really good job as the Secretary of Labor.
That's why I put it in there, is that I didn't get a chance to read that entire opinion to find out what the judge found that he violated the law. And the laws that he violated may not have been good laws, because I don't necessarily agree with everything about what victims are entitled to, but it is the law, and he did put his hand on the Bible.
Right.
And he's in a position now to try to change the law, and was then as well. If you're a prosecutor and you don't agree with the law, the Congress takes you very seriously as a federal prosecutor. If you have a problem with the law, you need to make that known, that the law is not fair, and whatever adjustment you need to make, you're considered credible. If you're a prosecutor and you think that that something's gone too far, particularly, you have more credibility than a defense attorney does. So, it'd be a good read for someone who wants to read it. But I thought it was kind of ironic that a cabinet member who was a former prosecutor, the judge accused him of not following the law.
Right. This is what the guy is accused of. It says the 60-year-old mogul lured scores of teenage girls from troubled homes, some as young as 13, as part of a cult-like scheme to sexually abuse them by offering them money to give him massages and promising some of them he would send them to college or help to find careers. That's a pretty stellar human, but he got convicted of like really, really low level things. Then it goes on to say that he served just about 13 months in the Palm Beach County Jail for all of those allegations. And to that, if I'm not mistaken, when we covered this 5 months ago or 4 months ago, you're like, well, they must not have had a very good case.
That okay. could have been it. Yep.
Absolutely.
Well could have been it. So could have been that he had a good case, or could have been something else.
Then another one out of Florida. So this is the Orlando Sentinel. Florida detective kills self out after he's accused of owning child porn. Oh, do we need to even cover any more than that?
Well, I think that to be intellectually consistent to a person taking their own life, like the young man that we talked about, was it last week or the week before?
Yeah, it was a couple of weeks ago.
That had consensual sex, apparently, and then there was a grainy video of it. The thing about this is that the consequences would have been so horrendous that I mean, he knew that his life was effectively over from the accusation. And if we've gotten to the point where people were committing suicide because of the draconian punishments and life-altering, lifelong consequences, it's probably time for us to take a look at where we are in this country. When it's that frightening that death is your only option as you see it.
It's not even a long article. It's just basically here's what happened. The guy was he was arrested on charges of possessing child porn, and then I don't even see how he allegedly did the deed. Honestly,
well, it was another county department that was investigating him. He was a decorated detective, according to the article. And then the neighboring St. John's County began an investigation in December after receiving a tip. And then apparently he was questioned on February 1st and denied looking at child porn. And then when they seize your computer, you know that they're going to figure out what you've been doing because they have great forensics work. And so
not to minimize somebody else that has, you know, gigs and gigs of images. Investigators say his computer was seized and two photos of naked children were found. I don't want to minimize this, but that's like, okay, two photos. Okay. Well, slap the guy on the wrist and move on.
Well, wasn't it juvenile males? We can't have that. We cannot have that in this country. Juvenile males wasn't it gay sex? Do I have it confused with another one?
It just says two photos, and I don't see anything. Well, detectives found an image of two adolescent boys doing the nasty.
Oh, yeah. See, we can't have that. I mean, if it was normal sex, it would be less appalling, but we definitely can't have that.
So if it was something hetero, it would be okay, but
it would be less objectionable. I mean, that is one of those double standards where we have that's pervasive in terms of how people are treated. You let a normal police officer roll up on people having sex and let it be gay sex and find out the reaction versus it being heterosexual sex in public. Now, both are illegal, generally speaking, but the treatment that the same-sex couple is going to get is usually going to be quite more severe unless that officer happens to be friendly. But yeah, it's one of those disparities that exist.
And then again, this is a place we've never covered anything from before. This is americantheater.org, and it's a publication of theater communications groups. This is, you know, I really wanted to cover this mostly because A, it's garbage, and B, the comments are really delightful. But the title of the article is Second Chances for a Sex Offender. And here's a person who, it's pretty recent. It's not like, you know, sometimes we cover articles from someone that was like, hey, I got convicted in 1970 and here I am 70 years old and I can't get a job at Walmart. But this person was a former teacher at a Christian school and convicted in 2009, for something indecent with a student, and he spent 8 years in prison. Ah, so now he's out and he's on the registry and he does theater. He's playing like, I think it would be the lead role in a play. And then someone just drops the bomb and goes like, well, you know, he's on the registry, right? And then that turns into a shitstorm. But the comments, it's actually a really long article. But one of the comments was like, dude, he did his time. If he's not maybe he's doing a play, and then after the play, they would have some, you know, like a gathering, and maybe he would have contact for kids. Maybe you would have objections there. That sounds like that would be legit. But if you're in the audience and you're 200, 300 seats in the audience and he's on stage, what is he going to do to you? Is he going to perv on you from the stage?
Well, but you don't understand. You don't understand. This is grooming behavior, Andy. He's doing that with the hope of finding someone who's turned on to his theatrical abilities, and they're going to rush the stage and want to get in there. And he knows that there are people working, wanting to get with him in the audience.
And so a lady then responded to the first comment, says, isn't pleading guilty and being convicted enough due process? Like, he already admitted guilt. That was his due process. Let the guy live. So then there's some stuff going on. The comments are worth reading, but we were well represented and defended against Daniela Cortez Alvarez, who decided to throw bombs at this person.
Yeah, I didn't read the entire article. I had not paid attention to it until now. I thought we were at the end of the articles, but yeah.
I just added this one just recently. I just saw this one tonight. It's a very recent article. It's from like in the last day or two. It's from February 22nd, which is to yesterday.
But it's unforgiving. I mean, he did his time. You'd think that they'd allow him to go on with his life, but we don't.
Nope, we don't. And even in a state like Alaska, that is almost 50% of the United States, and it only has like Moose and Anchorage.
And Fairbanks.
Oh, okay, Fairbanks too. And then obviously there's some oil floating around out there in the Exxon Valdez area, right?
Yeah, the port of Valdez where the tanker wrecked in 89 with the captain worked to a stupor.
Good times, man. Tell me about this. I guess that would be legislative bill because they don't have a House or Senate in Nebraska. What's going on up there?
Well, this is a long-running saga that I wish I had all the details on, but it's of interest to me because I've traveled to Nebraska to try to be helpful a few years ago, and their system fascinates me because it's so different, being that they only have a one-chamber unicameral legislature. And we talked about a case some number of episodes back where the Nebraska Supreme Court decided that people that have been adjudicated delinquent in other states, upon moving to Nebraska, they have to register, and how that was contrary to a federal court decision. And people rolled their eyes when I said, well, actually the state court rules. And they said, well, federal courts are higher than state courts, but they're not when they're interpreting state law. Right. And so the Nebraska Supreme Court, being a strict textualist interpretation, they read the law and said that it says, well, anybody who relocates to Nebraska has a registration obligation, in Nebraska. So even though the guy that was Clemens, he had been adjudicated in Colorado as a juvenile, they said, well, you are a person, aren't you? And he said, well, yes, I am. They said, well, you did move to Nebraska, did you not? And he said, well, yes, I did. And they said, well, you do have to register in Colorado, correct? And he said, yes, I do. And they said, well, it's black letter law. That's what the law says. You moved here, you had a registration obligation in another state, and you are a person, so therefore we need to go no further. Well, the federal court had decided that they looked at it a little differently. They looked at the intent of Nebraska law, which is Nebraska doesn't register adjudicated juveniles if the adjudication occurred within Nebraska. And up until then, they had not registered people who had adjudications from outside Nebraska. But now the Supreme Court of Nebraska said, well, that if the legislature wants it to say that, they can tell us that. But right now, we're looking at the black letters, and it says any person, and by golly, he's a person, and he did move here, and he has a registration obligation, so it's cut and dry. And it's amazing how many people that claim to be textualists have amazingly decided they're not textualists any longer. When I tell them, well, you said that you're a textualist, this is exactly what you would get from a textualist court. You should be happy and run with it. But amazingly, they wanted people to look at the intent, which is what the federal court did. Since the intent of Nebraska law is not to register juveniles, they said, well, it seems like logical to us that they would not want to register out-of-state offenders and not register in-state offenders. So but anyway, so there's an effort underway to fix that. And that's 2019 session, Legislative Bill 510. And it's attempting to carve out the exception that the person would not have to register if they were adjudicated from out of state, if they would not be required to register in Nebraska. And I don't think it's the most beautifully worded legislative proposal I've ever seen, but I think it would go a long way towards clearing up what the intent of the legislature is. But apparently the law enforcement apparatus, as I refer to it, has tried to hijack the bill. And they've got an amendment that they're offering. And the amendment is the most god-awful thing I've ever seen in my entire years of legislative business. There's no way in the world that this amendment should fly. The amendment, although it's in draft form, it's not actually been officially, it's not on the website, it has not been adopted by the Judiciary Committee, which has this proposal before them. But the amendment would, in exchange for carving out the out-of-state exceptions, it would create an obligation to register juveniles if they were adjudicated in Nebraska for the smaller universe of aggravated offenses, which is what the federal AWA requires for designation of substantial compliance. And that's one of the areas where Nebraska is still deficient. They don't register adjudicated juveniles over age 14 for aggravated sex offenses. And I don't believe they're listing employment on the internet yet. Last time I checked, they weren't. And that would be a deficient area because that's what the feds would like you to do.
So the
law enforcement apparatus is saying, well, if you bunch of liberal do-gooders want to protect these out-of-staters, we'd like to offer this as an amendment to the legislation. Well, I don't know whether the amendment's going to be adopted or not, but I did write an email to Hank, and which was to a whole lot of people in the thread, that there's no way in the world that this would be sound public policy for a number of reasons. They don't do anything to clarify if the registration obligation for the aggravated juvenile offenses would be prospective in application. So the way it's currently written, anybody who's ever been adjudicated in Nebraska for an aggravated offense can be within the zone of registrability. They don't offer any option to register on a law enforcement only registry, which is permissible for juveniles under the federal system. Tier ones and adjudicated juveniles do not have to be made public. So they could clearly, if they were determined to register juveniles, they could do it on a non-public database. I'm not advocating it, but I'm telling you that's what they could do. They could also register them with non-adult officials. They don't have to require the juveniles to go down to the local sheriff's office. They can designate the juvenile probation authorities as a registrar. They haven't done that. They haven't done anything to protect the juveniles from discrimination. If you're going to make this radical adjustment, to pacify law enforcement, which I wouldn't make the deal, but if you're going to make this deal, at least put in the statutes that the juveniles cannot be discriminated against in their educational opportunities and their extracurricular activities, and make sure that you make this registry private. But this is the most heinous thing I've ever seen as an amendment, and I hope they can it.
There you go again, ending the podcast on a dismal note.
Well, it's they're trying to fix a problem. There's Senator McAllister, I believe is the way I pronounce the name, is sponsoring the legislation, and he's trying to take the registry back to where it was before Clemens was decided by the state Supreme Court. And Hank said that apparently there's another stay being issued by the federal court to give the lawmakers a chance to see if they can figure out a way to carve out those people from having to be illuminated publicly. I thought they had already illuminated them, but apparently there's been another stay issued, and maybe they've not been illuminated. But I wouldn't make that trade-off. If it were me, the 75, 80, 85 people, whatever it is that have come from out of state, to illuminate hundreds of people retroactively as far back as they've had registration for all the aggravated offenses, I don't know what the total of that would be, but I don't think they do either. And to open the zone up for these juveniles to be discriminated against and harassed at school and to be denied competitive athletics. Can you imagine having a 16-year-old on a wrestling team after he's been adjudicated of a sexual offense? Can you imagine that, particularly now that wrestling teams have gone co-ed?
Right.
I mean, they would. I mean, there are already people who think that they're perving on each other, even when they're wrestling, when they haven't been convicted of a sex offense, and they think that's gross enough, but to have a kid that has wrestling abilities would not be allowed to wrestle because he had a sex offense?
Well, that would be a lot of touching.
And we definitely can't have that.
No, there will be no touching because that's not a good plan.
Well, I mean, that in football, that those are big sports in Nebraska.
There's no touching in football either.
Well,
it's a non-contact sport.
So, but yeah, it's just tragic that the cops are doing what cops would do. The law enforcement apparatus sees an opportunity to try to get their agenda, which is AWA compliance. And so here's a vehicle that's out there moving down the tracks, and they see an opportunity to try to, well, if they want this bad enough, maybe they'll make that compromise. I would say, sorry, Charlie, no compromise. That's not one we're willing to make. And I'm hoping that the Nebraska Senate feels the same way.
Right. How can people find the podcast, Larry?
It's not very easy, but it can be done.
It can be done. Do you need expertise in relationship management with your local politicians?
Well, if you want to find the podcast, the best thing to do is to Google Registry Matters.
Ah, Google.
It pops up in the first thing as you get when you Google Registry Matters. But if you don't want to Google, you can go to registrymatters.co and you'll find us there.
Hey, and I want to share this. If you want some fun times, I updated the voicemail message. So go listen to the new voicemail message. At what phone number?
That would be 747-227-4477.
Yes, I have listed explicit instructions on how to leave a voicemail message.
I appreciate that. Is there something complex about our voicemail system that's different than most?
Oh no, this is straight out of the 80s. There's a little cassette thing sitting on my counter in my kitchen, and when you dial in, it's like, you know, hey, thank you for calling the Registry Matters podcast. Leave your message at the beep, and literally then I hear beep and I hear people talk. And it's on a little micro cassette.
I've heard of that. So you've got micro cassettes.
Absolutely. No, but I recorded a new voicemail message and just left that people try to keep it under a minute, please. But there are things that I want you to say. And maybe if you say them, your message would get played. And if you don't say them, maybe your message doesn't get played.
And how do they write to us if they want to send us an email?
Send us an email message at registrymatterscast, and that would be for podcast and not like the cast of a play, but registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
All righty. And then what's the best way to support us?
Absolute best way is to, I think your instructions are, maybe they're a little bit murky because no one has taken you up on this offer yet. So maybe if I explain it. So when you get your paycheck stub, you're going to go over and you're going to see a net and a gross. Go down to where it says gross and just copy that number in and then click submit. That would be the best way to support the podcast.
So you're not even going to cut them a little slack for taxes and withholding. You just want them to do the gross amount.
Well, why not? Right. You could write it off. That won't work. We're not going there, but seriously, folks, $1 a month, it just shows your appreciation. That would be absolutely spectacular. To just donate $1 a month would be fine. And that would be at patreon.com/registrymatters. There's a Discord server that you'll gain access to, and you can join in on conversations. We have conversations going on there all week. People post articles, and then we can see how maybe they'll flesh out. Maybe I get ideas for questions to ask Larry on the podcast, or we can just hang out and talk about computers and other wacky things that probation does. There's also a place called shop.spreadshirt.com/registrymatters. That's with a hyphen in there, too. Registry-matters. You could buy t-shirts. I just bought a baseball cap because maybe I'm going to start doing YouTube videos. Not sure about that one yet. And then, yeah, so that's everything there.
Well, I forgot to mention that I am working on getting Janice Bellucci on regarding the district court decision out of Alabama regarding the compelled speech for the driver's licenses. It just hasn't come together yet, but I feel confident we'll get it done. So
yeah.
That decision is going to be discussed again. And I'd be very surprised if there's not an appeal.
Outstanding. So, well, beautiful. So Larry, as always,
we're working on it. We're working on it.
I so very much appreciate your time, energy, effort, and I hope that you will join me again very soon for another episode of Registry Matters.
From which network?
Oh, this is going to be the FYP network. Should I throw in a a little tag on the outgoing here?
That sounds good. All right.
Have a great night, Larry. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us here at FYP, and we hope you will join us again on our next broadcast.